welcome to the show. If it's Thursday night, it's time for Race Trackers. Last week, two favorites went down on the Derby Trail, and this week, attention goes to Tampa Bay Downs and Santa Anita. I'm Bill Gottemer, my usual co-host John Stenton and Mike Monroe. A little bit different time today, earlier show at 3 p.m. on Thursday due to my travel schedule, but I hope those who are listening in at 8 o'clock are listening to the tape. Please remember that you can always get a tape of the show. It's always available at Blog Talk Radio. As you know, each week we try to capture what has transpired in the racing world and bring new information to our listeners. We ask you to spread the word about how much fun we have here each Thursday night. I hope to be joined later on by Mike Monroe as my co-host. He'll give us some winners. Until that time, I'll handle the show by myself. Mike's pick last week at Gulfstream, last weekend Eastport for Shug McGahee was an impressive winner, as was Mike's choice in the Fountain of Youth, Guinevere. Eastport's a nice developing three-year-old owned by Robert Evans and trained by Shug McGahee. He showed a nice closing punch and a nice dimension, and I wouldn't be surprised to see him move into the stakes category sometime shortly. I guess Shug McGahee said he would be looking for an allowance race for the horse, hoping to go two turns, but I wouldn't be surprised to see Eastport make an impact later on this year at some point. We also had the winner last week of the Gotham. J-Boy Zecco for Dale Romans proved a nice winner from off the pace, just as Jonathan Stenton and Mike Monroe had predicted, moving from the outside post in the earlier race to the inside post helped him tremendously, as did the early pace. The early pace took its toll on favorite Ella Reeb, who was ridden by our friend Trevor McCarthy. He got caught up in a speed duel and succumbed with more than a half mile to go. That left the race open, the Gotham open, for a nice closing kick by J-Boy Zecco, and he seems to be a factor on the Derby Trail moving forward. In that same race, Chad Brown's horse ran a very nice second and also would be expected to be part of the Wood Memorial Field moving forward in New York in a few weeks. Our other selection last week at Gulfstream, Snap Decision, another horse for Shug McGahee, ran in spots, finished a closing third, a little bit disappointed by the effort, was beaten by Chad Brown's beautiful horse, Ticonderoga, who ran a huge effort. But I did hope Snap Decision would have gotten up for second. He hung a little bit in the lane, but I still think he's a horse who's learning how to play the game and will probably be a factor moving forward. Gulfstream was really the place to be last week. Saw a number of top efforts. Celestine running the first time for Christopher Clement after a private sale after last year's Breeders' Cup was impressive, beating formerly champion Catch a Glimpse for Mark Cassie. What struck me most about those two horses was the size differential. Celestine, so much larger and so much bigger than Catch a Glimpse, took the lead from the outset under Jose Ortiz and dared Catch a Glimpse to catch her, and she was unable to. Shortly later on in the card, Suffused, horse from Judmont Farm, just continues to get better. She was extremely impressive for Bill Mott, and now has won at a number of different distances and seems to be getting better and better. The ease with which Suffused won that race last week was really, really quite outstanding. Further down on the card in Gulfstream, Fayak, who's a half to Rachel Alexandra, had a nice debut, finishing third for Kieran McLaughlin, and again will probably be a horse that will bear some watching, will probably make an impact later on this year. The aforementioned Ticonderoga was very impressive for Chad Brown, who continues to win races all over the country, but Ticonderoga came back from its difficult trip in the Breeders' Cup and just was extremely impressive, seems to have learned the game, moved right at the right time, followed rider's instructions, rider's directive beautifully, and really seems to be a horse that will in fact make a big impact moving forward this year. The Fountain of Youth turned out to be a big disappointment for odds-on favorite Irish War Cry, who was basically a no-show. Irish War Cry tried to rate behind the leader and really came up totally empty. Practical Joke, another Chad Brown trainee, ran a very big race to be second, but Guanavera under Javier Castellano set the perfect trip from behind, looped the field, and was a rather easy winner. As we pointed out on the show last week, in the prior race, when Guanavera tried to catch Irish War Cry, he was stopped at a critical time and showed quite a bit of agility in re-rallying. That being said, it seems like Javier Castellano has announced that he's keeping his options open and has not necessarily declared Guanavera as his Derby horse. We'll probably see a rematch of a number of these horses back in the Florida Derby in a few weeks. Graham Motion reports that Irish War Cry came out of the race well and really does not have an explanation as to why the horse ran so poorly, but seems undeterred and probably will continue on the Derby trail. Three Rules ran a huge race in the Fountain of Youth, showing that he can carry his speed a distance of ground, finishing a game third at a distance that's probably not his best in his first try around two turns. Three Rules will probably, in my estimation, go back to sprints, and again will be a horse to be reckoned with. One very disappointing and one troubling matter out of the Fountain of Youth was the breakdown of Hurricane America. Hurricane America was the horse that we spoke about last week from Peru and seemed to be overmatched going in, was very high odds, took a bad step down the backside, broke down, and was euthanized. There continues to be what I believe is an ill-conceived desire to have foreign horses participate in the Derby trail. And what this leads to, it leads to worldwide interest, of course, which is what it's trying to drum up to, and international competition is not a bad thing. But it seems to have resulted in a number of horses who are overmatched trying their hand in big races. And I don't know if you can directly have a cause and effect between being overmatched and breaking down. It's never good for a horse to be overmatched. You know, horses taxed more than necessary and put in a position where he's not comfortable. So, you know, we mourn the loss of Hurricane America, and probably would be a better idea to be more judicious in which foreign horses are able to or asked to try the top horses here in the U.S. In the same race, Kieran McLaughlin's horse, Tackiful, proved again to be unrateable. He's intractable, seems to be a bit of a runoff, and until they find an ability to have him rate properly or to ration out his speed, he will continue to be a work in progress. He has a tremendous turn of foot, but if he can't harness that excitement and that ability, it'll be difficult for him to compete at the top level, particularly going a distance of ground. As we spoke about before, the other race at Aqueduct was the Gotham, and while it appeared to be a rematch and appeared to have Ella Reeb to have the field at his mercy, that did not turn out to be the case. Ella Reeb was beaten at short odds after being pressed early and being pressed rather vigorously. He gave it up with more than a half mile to go, setting up the race for Jay Boy's Echo, who got the trip, and crowd control for Chad Brown, who ran a huge race. I think many people have reevaluated their Derby prospects after last week's race, and we probably would expect the same thing this week. This week looks like we'll have two Derby preps, which we'll speak about in a minute. But at this time of year, three-year-olds develop rather rapidly, and horses who look extremely impressive 1 week don't necessarily carry that over. And until someone does, it seems to be, again, a wide-open Derby, and a Derby that probably is ripe for the taking for someone who comes into the race the first Saturday in May healthy and probably recently matured. One horse who needs no maturing right now and continues to intrigue people about what her chances would be in the Kentucky Derby is Unique Bella. We've spoken of Unique Bella so many times on this show. She's such an impressive physical specimen. And last week at odds of 1-9, she again proved to be a winner. She had a little more of an eventful trip this time under Mike Smith. She broke from the inside and she missed the break. She missed the break and probably spotted the field maybe a length or two. And Mike Smith hustled her a little to get her into gear so she didn't fall too far behind after the bad start. And once he gave her the go ahead, she took the suggestion seriously and ran up into that first turn and almost ran over the two leaders. Mike Smith had a difficult time finding a seam to run through between the two leaders, and as he said, he was just going to run right over them if he hadn't. In fact, when he split the horses going into the first turn, he impeded the horse to his outside a little bit. That was not a claim of foul, but that came dangerously close to having an incident that would have led to an injury or leading to a disqualification. Once Unique Bella extricated herself from that difficulty around the turn, she proved clearly the best down the backside, opened up a lead at will on the turn, and cruised into the stretch unopposed and unasked. At that point, there was a strong, strong challenge put forth to her by Abel Talisman, who looked for a point like she was going to get the best of Unique Bella and this was going to spring an upset. But Mike Smith reminded Unique Bella the race wasn't done, asked her to run a little bit, and she drew off rather convincingly. It was a good race for both horses. Unique Bella, I guess there's been some discussion that it wasn't as impressive as her other races, but in many ways it was because she overcame some difficulty, including a bad start. She got jostled around a little bit on that first turn, and after cruising in through the stretch, she responded as you expect a good horse to do when asked by Mike Smith. All in all, I thought it was a very good race, but I think also makes a lot of people believe that she would be competitive with the Colts if she were to decide to run in the Kentucky Derby. But her connections, trainer Jerry Hollendorfer, and so far her owners seem steadfast in their stated intention of staying with the fillies and looking to run in the Kentucky Oaks as opposed to the Kentucky Derby. There'll probably be an opportunity for her to meet males somewhere down the line if she needs to. But I thought it was a very good effort by her, despite some people feeling it wasn't quite as impressive as her previous efforts. As a side note, the horse who finished second, Abel Tasman, ran so well, has been now moved from one barn to another, and has been their owners have changed trainers, reportedly over aggravation over a mishap as to which silks she ran in that race. So I guess it just goes to show you again what a difficult game this can be, that you can train a horse like Abel Tasman to run so well that she gives her a tussle and then find yourself fired from the job because of a silks mishap. And that's too bad. The horse moves to Bob Baffert now, which of course is a high profile trainer. And I believe one of the owners is the China Horse Club, who has a relationship with Bob Baffert. So maybe that was in the works prior to the silks mishap. But it's a very difficult break for trainer Simon Callahan, who had Abel Tasman in a good enough shape to tangle with Unique Bella, only to find that he's been relieved of his command. And I guess the report is that the filly should have won the China Horse Club silks, and she didn't. So that's really too bad for him. I mean, it's a difficult game worrying about horses, and to have such a tenuous relationship with an owner that you lose over silks is quite the shame. That takes care of last week. We had some news last week also. And some of the news last week, there were two jockeys who won their first race. And one of them, Carlos Carrasco, won his first two lifetime starts. So it's hard to start better than that. I guess you could start 3 for 3, but his first two lifetime starts were winners at Laurel. And he's the younger brother of Victor Carrasco. And congratulations to Carlos Carrasco on starting off his career with a bang with two straight winners. That's always nice to see. Another young man who won his first race in the U.S., not necessarily his first race overall, but his first race in the United States, was Dexter Haddock. Dexter Haddock won a race at Philadelphia Park, bit of a wide trip that he had, but congratulations to him. He had won a race previously in Puerto Rico, and he seems like he'll be a new apprentice who will apply his trade at Philadelphia Park and seems to be getting some mounts. So congratulations to Dexter Haddock on his first U.S. win. Congratulations to Carlos Carrasco on winning his first two starts. Hopefully the future is bright for both of those young men. On a sad note, and not necessarily a thoroughbred note, but on a sad note, the Communications Hall of Fame announcer in the standardbred game, Sam McKee, died at the early age of 54 this week. He was well-known and well-respected announcer in the harness game, and he died Wednesday morning as a result of complications from a stroke he had suffered early last month. And again, he was only 54, so our condolences out to track announcer Sam McKee. Just a terrible loss for all concerned. That concludes last week. This week we hope to have, in the next few minutes, I hope to have the pleasure of interviewing Stuart Elliott, who is this year's recipient of the George Wolfe Memorial Award, which is one of the highest honors that a jockey can receive. And I'm hoping we'll have him call in a few minutes. At this point, I'd like to thank our guest from last week, Zoe Cadman, and thank her for her contribution last week and her interesting conversation. And, of course, I'd like to thank Mike Monroe for going over the card and giving us some winners. We will probably have an additional increased focus on this show going forward on some handicapping and hoping to kind of focus on the week's races coming up and hope to give a winner or two. Between John Stetton and Mike Monroe, and to a much lesser extent me, we've had some luck in giving out horses over the week, and certainly horses to watch, and certainly have a few winners. And I know our listeners like it, either from a betting standpoint or from an interest standpoint. So look for us moving forward to be more handicapping centric, and we hope we'd be interested in having anybody's opinion on that. And people, if you have selections, you can send it to racetrackers@verizon.net, or you can call us and we can go over some handicapping methods. With that, I want to look a little forward to this week and some horses you should watch. This week, as most weeks, most of the action is on Saturday. And on Saturday at Oak Lawn, we'll start with Oak Lawn in Hot Springs, Arkansas, which is a beautiful place if you've never been to it. And Whitmore returns. Whitmore was a fixture on last year's Triple Crown Trail and had many followers. Whitmore's a nice horse, and he comes back in a sprint on the sixth race at Oak Lawn. So Whitmore is certainly a horse to see whether or not he's going to be a factor in the four-year-old older handicap division, and it'll be interesting to see how he runs on Saturday. Likewise, two races later, in the Honeybee, Bill Mott brings back a late. And if you remember, a late was the horse we spoke about a few weeks ago who was so impressive in her maiden victory in New York before taking the winter off and came back at Tampa Bay and was at very short odds, 1-5 or 2-5, and Bill Mott was very clear in saying that a late was not fully cranked up for that effort and would improve off that effort. And she ran second to a nice horse down in Tampa Bay, disappointed a number of gamblers, but in fact probably got a lot out of that, and now resurfaces in the Honeybee at Oak Lawn. And that'll be race 8 on Saturday, a late Bill Mott. My guess is she'll be favored. But she'll probably run a big race and probably has a big future ahead of her, and that's probably a horse to watch despite her loss last time at short odds. A lot of the focus this week, as I said earlier, is on Tampa Bay Downs and Santa Anita, and we'll talk a little bit about Tampa Bay Downs. Tampa Bay Downs this week, race 9 is an interesting race. Race 9 at Tampa Bay has the return of a horse called La Coronel. And La Carnell ran a huge race in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile last year, and probably might have been the best horse in the race, only to find herself have a bit of a rough trip, and wind up sixth. When you look at that, she was favored in the race, but she was five wide into the stretch after breaking from the extreme outside post under Florent Giroux, and she makes her return in a nice spot on Saturday at Tampa Bay Downs, Florida Oaks, Grade 3 race. And I would think that La Carnell, for Mark Cassie, would probably come back running, probably a horse to beat, probably a horse to make a wager on under Florent Giroux. That's race number 9, Saturday, Tampa Bay Downs, La Carnell. The big race, though, of course, on the Tampa Bay Downs card is the Florida Derby. And the Florida Derby is now Grade 2 race, mile and a 16th, and has proven to be one of the more effective Derby preps. It's a big purse, $350,000. It's drawing a full field. In the absence of some of the big favorites, it looks like a wide open race. But many people are focused upon Taprit, who is a three-year-old son of Tappet, not surprisingly for Todd Pletcher, who ran second last time to McCracken under Jose Ortiz, and had a bit of a strange trip and seemed to run in spots, but had stepped up tremendously from his previous races. So as a son of Tappet, he's beautifully bred, as by definition, seems to have liked the added distance. And the second time under Jose Ortiz, second time over the track at the same distance, probably is a deserving favorite. And I think a lot of people have high hopes for Taprit, who, as I said, lost to McCracken last time, but seems to have gained quite a bit of excitement from many handicappers, including our own John Stetton. So that's race 11, Tampa Bay Downs. It's about 5:25 Eastern time on Saturday, and we'll see whether Taprit moves forward with a Derby horse for our friend Jose Ortiz. The other action, and the real action, I think, this week is at Santa Anita. This is the Santa Anita Handicap, the home of the big cap. The Santa Anita Handicap used to be the only $100,000 race in the country. It was the horse that Seabiscuit tried so many times to win, and really became a bit of a thorn in his side, always trying to win the hundred grander, as they called it back then. And this year it comes up somewhat light, because it seems to have the unfortunate factor of being trapped between what's now the Pegasus World Cup and the Dubai World Cup. So Arrogant and many of the top horses are going to Dubai after running in the Pegasus World Cup, but that leaves still a big race and still a nice field which we'll get to in a minute. But prior to that, the Derby prep that most people are looking forward to this week, and one that has a lot of excitement, is the Grade 2 San Felipe. San Felipe has drawn a small field of 7. But one of them is Bob Baffert's horse, Mastery. Mastery is undefeated in 3 starts, all of which he was heavily favored. He was heavily favored at 30 cents to the dollar, 30 cents to the dollar, and 20 cents to the dollar, and won each easily, all 3 easily under Mike Smith. He is now trying Santa Anita for the second time. He broke his maiden there, and he seems to be Bob Baffert's big chance this year for the Triple Crown. And as we know from history, anything that Bob Baffert sends out in pursuit of the Triple Crown races, the classics, has to be taken very seriously. So there's a lot of excitement to see Mastery make his first start since December, and we'll see whether this son of Candy Ride can in fact remain undefeated and move forward towards the Santa Anita Derby and then eventually the Kentucky Derby. He'll be met by Gormley, who's a very nice horse, by John Sheriffs, who's won 3 out of 4 Tug O'Neill has a horse named Iliad, who's also a very nice horse. So it's not an empty field, but Mastery will be favored. I believe he'll be odds on. He may be as low as 1-2, but that is certainly the race to keep an eye on Saturday at Santa Anita, and that's at 2 p.m. Pacific time, so 5 p.m. Eastern time, race 5 at Santa Anita. As you move down the card, it's a beautiful card. The eighth race is interesting for a whole host of reasons. It's the Kilroy Mile. It's interesting for a couple reasons. One, again, Mike Smith rides back Masochistic. Masochistic, if you remember, ran second in the Breeders' Cup, but was disqualified for a steroid positive that arose much later. And in fact, has been disqualified, I believe, for life from the Breeders' Cup efforts. But that being said, Masochistic is still a nice horse. He makes his 7-year-old debut. He seems to love Santa Anita. He's 4-for-7 over the course, and he expects to be odds on, although he is running at 7 furlongs, which is not, by far, is not. Even though he's 3-for-3, 7 furlongs is not, in my opinion, his best distance, as he's a pure sprinter. Even though he's won 3 races out of 3 starts at 7 furlongs, I believe he's better at 6. He may be somewhat vulnerable. He faces Kobe's Back, who Javier Castellano will be running, and probably is a dead closer who probably would have an opportunity in the final yards to catch up to Masochistic. So that's certainly a good race to watch. Speaking of Javier Castellano, congratulations to Javier Castellano on the well-deserved nomination to the Racing Hall of Fame. And I believe that he will, be inducted into the Hall of Fame come this August. And I certainly hope so. He and a number of other extremely worthy candidates, but Javier Castellano strikes me as the one whose Hall of Fame credentials ring quite true. And we look forward to speaking to him about that as and when that happens. Continuing on the Santa Anita card, Santa Anita card race 9 is the Kilroy Mile. It's a grade 1 on the grass for a mile for 4-year-olds and up. And it's always an interesting race, but what's extremely interesting about this race is Dortman makes his first start for Art Sherman after being transferred out of the Bob Baffert barn, and also makes his first start on turf. It's a somewhat surprising move. He takes blinkers off and moves to the turf for Art Sherman, and he changes riders to Victor Espinosa. So a complete makeover for Dortman. And it's somewhat surprising because Dortman does not seem to particularly have turf breeding. And as such, you don't know whether this is just an attempt to get a race into him, but it's a grade 1, so obviously Art Sherman thinks that the horse has an opportunity. I don't see whether he's even worked on the grass, although he may have. And his body type doesn't necessarily strike me as the horse who would skip over the grass. If you remember, Dortman is huge. He's monstrous, and he's big, and he's lumbering, which is not always conducive to running on the grass. But that being said, you know, far be it from us to question Art Sherman. It will be interesting to see what he gets out of Dortman in the new barn. He'll face Bolo, who's also a huge horse, which will be interesting. The two of them break out of the gates right next to each other, the posts 3 and 4, and there's going to be an awful lot of horse flesh in that contained area there. So that's that will be an interesting matchup for us all to see at Santa Anita Race 9. Also, our friends at West Point Thoroughbred and Graham Motion have Ring Weekend in there. Ring Weekend continues to fire every time, and has stayed out on Santa Anita and seems to like Santa Anita. Last time had a little bit of a rough trip, comes back again with the same punch, and has as good a chance as any. So we'll root for Ring Weekend to face Dortman and Bolo in Race 9 at post time 4 p.m. Pacific time, so 7 p.m. Eastern time, Santa Anita Race 9. As we move further into the nighttime, Race 10 is the big cap. And Race 10 is 4:30 Pacific time, 7:30 Eastern time. So if you're here on the East, you can watch dinner and watch the big Santa Anita handicap. And we'll speak about that in just a moment. I'd like to welcome our guest, Stuart Elliott, to the program. Good afternoon, Stuart. Welcome to Racetrackers.
Oh, thank you. Good afternoon.
So happy to have you. I'm sure you need no introduction to our riders, but to our listeners rather. But we'll do it anyway. Stuart Elliott's been a rider, professional rider on the circuits, the U.S. circuits for many years, approaching 5,000 wins, approaching $100 million in purse earnings, has well known for riding Smarty Jones to victories in the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness, and most recently has been announced as this year's recipient of the George Wolfe Memorial Award. So welcome and congratulations.
Thank you very much.
For our listeners, Stuart, tell us a little bit about the George Wolfe Memorial Award. I guess it's one of the highest honors the jockey can get, and I think most impressively, it's awarded by other jockeys, correct?
Yes, exactly. All the jockeys throughout the United States at all the different racetracks, they do the voting, and that's what it's all about. It's the other jockeys voting on it.
And it's you're too modest to say what it is, but it's for demonstrating the highest standards of personal and professional conduct both on and off the track. So it's a tremendous honor, I believe, just in its own right, but for it to be awarded to you by your peers is quite a measure and quite an honor.
Yes, absolutely. I found out, I guess it's been about a week ago, and I was surprised and honored, very honored.
Well, it's for our listeners who don't recall, George Wolfe was the famous rider of Seabiscuit and had an untimely death, but this award has been given out for more than 50 years. Am I correct on that?
I think so. I'm not exactly sure how long, but I think it's right around that area. Yeah, 50 years or so.
Well, it's a tremendous honor, and certainly congratulations. It's certainly not the cap to your career, but it's just has to be a wonderful honor, and congratulations.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
We'd want to talk for a little bit to our listeners, if we can, of your history in racing. My understanding is you come from a racing family as a child.
Yes, I grew up around the horses. My father was a jockey. I was born in Toronto, Canada, and he was riding in Canada. And then when I was 7 years old, we went to Hong Kong. He went over there to ride. He was having a lot of trouble making the weight in Canada, in the United States. And over in Hong Kong, the scale of weights were higher. So we went over there for 5 years. I was like seven to 13 when we returned. And when we returned, we came to the States, to New Jersey, actually. My parents bought a horse farm in New Jersey, and my father went to training horses, and my mom and dad, but my mom also had riding horses that she would give riding lessons. So I was around it, pretty much the whole time. When I was in Hong Kong, I would get to see it, but I really didn't get to get on any horses too much, a little bit here and there. So I basically was around them all the time, and then I started riding them at a young age. When we came back from Hong Kong, we started showing horses, and I was at the racetrack all the time, when I wasn't in school, in the summers and that. So it was very easy for me to learn and get into.
I mean, you've had a long career. I think you've been riding for, I guess, well over 20 years, but approaching 30, I guess. What is the key to that longevity and staying in riding shape that long?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of it is, you know, you have to stay healthy, number one. You know, it's a dangerous sport. You can get hurt a lot and bad. And so you have to, you know, have to have some luck on your side that way. You have to stay pretty healthy. And you have to be able to maintain your weight. You know, some jockeys are naturally light, and others, others have to work at it. You know, some of them are heavy. They really have to, you know, keep their weight down and stay on strict diets and reduce, jog, get the hop off. So there's a lot of involved, you know, involved with luck and the weight and your business. You know, you have to hopefully, you know, have good enough business where you know, you can keep making a decent living, and you have good years, you have slow years. There's a lot of ups and downs. So it's not an easy game. So there's a lot of luck. And just, you know, staying healthy, I guess, would be the main thing.
Right, right. Well, you made your mark, if I'm not correct, originally on the East Coast with the Philadelphia Park, which is now Parks, for our listeners who don't know. And I guess there you started up a partnership with Smarty Jones, which was just a wonderful horse and a wonderful partnership for you and he. Do you want to talk a little bit about him?
Sure. Yeah, you know, I was riding. I've been riding. I'd actually been in New England. I had my apprenticeship in New Jersey, Atlantic City, Philadelphia area, which is Park. I had the apprentice there. You know, the bug they call it. And then I actually went to New England for about 5 or 6 years. I had an uncle who trained in Canada. And he would went to Suffolk that one winter. It was like in 83, right after I'd lost the bug. And I was doing pretty good, but he called me and he said, I'm taking about 20 head to Suffolk down for the winter. If you want to come and ride them, you know, come on. So anyway, I went up there and I ended up staying there. He went back to Toronto. That was the plan. I was going to go back to Toronto with him. But I was doing very good there, so I stayed there. And, you know, I stayed there for about 5 or 6 years. Then I went to Toronto and I rode up there for a season. Then I ended up being around the East Coast, which was, you know, kind of home. That's where my mom and dad had trained, where I started off. So I'd been on the East Coast for many years, Monmouth Park. You know, we could go to Maryland, an hour and a half away, a couple hours away. An hour and a half, you got New York. A lot of racing, you know.
Right.
So I was in that area for a long time. And then came Smarty Jones, yeah, which was great, you know, to get a horse like of that quality from that area. Most of the good horses, as you know, they'll come out of New York or California. So it was really great and to get a horse like that, and then to be able to, you know, to stay with that horse and to go on and go all the way to the Kentucky Derby was just great, you know.
Well, I think for our listeners, I think it was the fact, it's probably changed now, but it was the fact that I think as a jockey, you had the most lucrative ride, I think, of all time on the Derby, because the purse of the Derby was $1 million, and there was a $5 million bonus, I think, that you were also entitled to for winning the Derby with Smarty Jones. Is that correct?
Yes, what happened was, you know, Smarty Jones, he broke his – he won his first race in Philadelphia Parks. He ran there. Then he went to New York. Then he went to the wintertime to Arkansas, to Oaklawn Park. And Oaklawn Park have the three Derby preps, which is the Southwest Stakes, the Rebel Stakes, and the Arkansas Derby. And they had, for any horse that could win all three of those preps and then go on and win the Kentucky Derby, there was a $5 million bonus. And Smarty Jones did that. So that's how that happened.
Yeah, that's quite the run there, right? That's it's hard to win one race, let alone fall like that. And
yeah.
And you were You know, yeah, it's just with the shipping involved. And but despite that, he wasn't favored in the Derby, and he wasn't, I don't believe, and I don't think he was taken all that serious. How confident were you going into the Derby?
I was pretty confident. You know, this horse, he was a very fast horse. Like when he broke his maiden, when he won his very first race, it was 3/4 mile at Parkston. He just went to the lead. He just went out there, opened up, and just kept going. And I was thinking, you know, the first time I rode him, that he was running too fast the first part of the race. He wasn't relaxed. He was just going as fast as he could for as far as he could. And I'm, you know, come out of there about an eighth of a mile, I'm thinking, oh, man, he's not relaxing for me. He's never going to keep going like this. So the whole thing with that horse was, can we get him to slow down and relax and save it, you know, and stretch out? You know, he's got a 7/8. Can he go a mile? Can he go a mile and an eighth, mile and a quarter, and so forth? So that's what happened. And we were able to teach him to relax and throttle down and then, you know, run at the end. And he did that. But it was kind of a race-by-race thing. We didn't know whether he would keep going because every race got further.
Right.
But by the time we got to the, by the time you know we got to the Kentucky Derby, I knew we were in pretty good shape. I thought we had the best horse. It was just, you know, a lot of things can happen in horse racing, you know, and then every race you don't know, are they going to come out of the race okay, you know, a lot of different things can happen. But as far as the horse, I thought we were in good shape.
Yeah, well, you had a dream trip in the Derby, and then you moved on to the Preakness, and the Preakness this time, of course, you were the one to beat, and it looked like Mike Smith did a little race riding, if I recall, kind of trying to either take you wide or force you to go inside with Smarty Jones, and it seems at the top of the stretch you did go inside, but you had so much horse it just seemed to be he was immune to any sort of race riding at that point, right?
Yeah, it didn't matter. You know, it didn't matter. You know, they say Mike, you know, maybe he did, you know, but Mike's horse would try to get out. He,
okay.
I watched him. Yeah, I knew the horse, and I know I saw Mike on him, and he would, if you took a hold of him, he would try to get out. Now, maybe Mike used that to his advantage a little bit, sure. Possibly, you know, and maybe it was just the horse. Maybe Mike figured, you know, let him do it because I'm outside of him. But I had so much horse, it really didn't matter. I could have went inside, outside. It wasn't going to matter. My horse would win very easily. But, you know, he by the time we got to the far turn, I could see Mike was, it didn't look like he was going to get his horse back in. And there was, like, enough room for two horses. And I had so much horse, I went inside. And I went inside just easy, you know, little by little. I could have been gone through there and, you know, but I had plenty of horse. That horse won that race very easily.
You have 3 weeks and you're on to the frenzy of the Triple Crown at Belmont in New York, and you have media attention and media glare. It's been so long since there'd been one. I think there'd been 26 years or so, and you had the hopes of Philadelphia seemed to really embrace this horse, right? I mean, do I recall that when Smarty Jones worked out at Philadelphia Park, they had a couple of thousand people go out to see him in the morning. Am I remembering that correct? Okay.
Yeah, that's right. He had a lot of fans from Philadelphia there, Smarty Jones, and from Arkansas actually. But his hometown there in Philadelphia, people were going crazy about him. You know, he had a lot of fans, and they would come and watch him work out.
Just so much excitement, you know, for the game, and you weathered that storm, and you got into the Belmont, and now the Belmont, you really have the target on you, and you have to go a mile and a half, and it just seems like everybody took a shot at you during that race. Do you anything you want to say about that? Well, you ran, Smarty Jones ran gallantly, but was caught in the final 70 yards, I guess, by a horse who had a perfect trip, Birdstone. Any recollections that you want to share on that whole trip?
Yeah, he just, you know, like I said, he was a very fast horse. He could get sharp, and he was really good throughout all his races. You know, he was very manageable. But in the Belmont, he got a little bit sharp. He got a little bit ranked. And, you know, there were other horses. There were other horses kind of pressing him a little bit. Of course, they knew he was the horse to beat. But I knew on the first turn he was pulling. He was pulling and just wouldn't settle down. And I knew on the first turn, I said, this is not the way we're going to – this is – you can tell usually – in a race, you know, when it's the way it sets up, whether you're, you know, sometimes you're thinking that this is perfect. I'm right where I want to be. He's running great. But with him, it was the opposite. I said, this the way he's running is just not going to work. We have too far to go, and he's not going to do it like this, running this way. And that's just what happened. He was too sharp. He wouldn't settle, and he still almost won the race. So
right. I mean, he ran. He was gallant in defeat, and Rock Hard 10, if I remember, was a beautiful looking specimen of a horse. And every time you looked at him in the paddock or the post parade, you thought he was gonna be the horse to beat. He was so strong looking, and that was probably one of the biggest races he ran. He took it right to Smutty Jones right from the start, and you defeated him, but it took its toll. I guess one other thing, and I guess I always like to ask people this who've been part of this. I've been to every Belmont for the last, I don't know, 40 years, I guess, except but for one. That was the largest crowd I ever remember. That was before they had caps on the card, and I think they had 120,000 people there. It was truly chaotic. Do you remember that having an effect, or I guess the second question, do you feel that roar of the crowd when you turn for home?
Oh, you can hear it. Yeah, there was so many people there. It was huge. But, I mean, it was the same in all the races, you know, the Derby, Arkansas. You know, those fans used to – that place used to fill up. But, yeah, that's just, you know, you can hear the crowd. But that had no effect on the race or anything.
Okay. I mean, I just remember that as being the one that, in my mind, was among the most chaotic because there was just – so many people. I mean, you know, 60,000 or 80,000 is one thing. When you push it up to 120, it really, you know. And now, of course, they've since capped it. But I just remember that the noise level on that one is just being off the charts.
They were all. I think all those people, you know, that we thought we were going to have our next Triple Crown winner too. You know, so it was really a big deal, and that place was really packed. I mean, it was. You could hear them. The funny thing is, it was so loud. I remember it being so noisy, like just for the post parade and before the race, and even during the race. But after he got beat, it was quiet.
That's right. I think Edgar Prado rode the winner, right? And I think he was almost apologetic at some point. I think to people that he had kind of spoiled the day.
Yeah, Edgar. Me and Edgar, you know, we've known each other a long time. Even back then, we had known each other a long time. We had ridden together up in New England, in Boston, and Rockingham Park in New Hampshire. And when he went by me after the wire, and he was, like, apologetic for it. You know, he felt bad. I mean, he had his job to do it, and he was happy for himself. But at the same time, you know, he felt bad for us, for me and the connections, and I guess, you know, by beating by defeating the Triple Crown winner, you know.
Right, right. Well, you never want to. Of course, you never want to. You never want to win anything that where people aren't trying hard against you. So that's obviously what makes it special, right? That everyone
right,
tries their hardest
right.
to.
Yeah.
I guess when I look back on that Derby field, the horse that you beat in that race was Tappet, who's gone on to become the sire of all sires now, and as everyone seems to be. It's funny when you look back at all the races, you see some names that you went on to stud to become something special. So it's it seems like you can't turn anywhere now without seeing Tappet as the sire of a big horse. But you moved out. You're out to California now, and you're having a good season out in California. You're riding for a number of different barns, which is always you know a key to getting many mounts. And I assume you're happy out there in California. I see you riding a bunch of horses this week. Anybody you want to talk about for this weekend for our listeners?
I got a few. I just ride one today. That horse has a chance. I ride four tomorrow, and then Saturday we have a big day. Saturday, I think I'm on six. A couple of horses have some chances. There's a filly that I liked it. I win a stake on it back this summer in Del Mar. Her name is You're Late. I think she's going to run really good. She's been off a while. She's been freshened up. I've been working her. She's been working really great. So maybe she's ready to win, you know?
Excellent. That's Saturday, Santa Anita, seventh race. But without asking you to tout horses, I don't mean to do that. I don't mean to be. I just you know, any horses you're excited with. You've gotten to see. We're going to talk to you about another horse for a while. Being out in California, you've gotten to see Unique Belle, or I'm sure up close. Is she as impressive looking in person as she seems to be on television?
Yeah, she really is. She looks very good. I mean, she looks like she's the real deal. You know, she's. She looks like another special one. She looks really great.
Yeah, it's a lot of excitement having one that's that good. I thought last week there were some people criticizing her race last week as not being that impressive. I thought it was very impressive. She kind of suffered a bad break and hustled up between horses and then responded when challenged. I mean, I don't know what more you can ask for a horse. I thought it was a good learning experience for her.
Yeah, exactly. I thought it was a great race. Like you said, she got away a little slow. She got kind of pinched a little going into that first turn, and she kind of just goes on and does her business. And then, you know, the true test was when that horse come to her and Mike asked her, and she responded, and she did what she had to do. I think it was great, you know.
Yeah, it's a lot of excitement, and I hope they – I guess a lot of people are thinking that she would be competitive in the Derby. I hope they do that if they challenge boys. I hope it's later. You know, there's plenty of time for that if they need to. But she's certainly a lot of excitement. I guess we're looking towards the West Coast. It's a big day Saturday with a lot of the stakes races, and it's. I guess you finally got a break in the weather out there. That track has come back to normal.
Yes, exactly. We were getting so much rain out here. You know, we'd get a week where it would rain two or three days, and we'd lose the turf racing, and the track would get muddy. Then it would clear up. We'd just get to where the track was good again, and then here the rain would come again. It happened like three or four times. Now it looks like we're having some pretty steady good weather, and there's no rain in the forecast, and it's looking pretty good.
Well, excellent. Well, I want to let you. I know you're calling during the racing day. I want to let you get back to. And I can't thank you enough for being on. I do want to speak. You're going to receive the award, the George Wolf Memorial Award, on March 26th, right at Santa Anita, right? It's after one of the races. Is that when they give it out?
Yes, that's right. Yep.
So hopefully we'll be able to see that on TVG for all our listeners, and it's a well deserved award, and you should be wildly proud. I mean, the list of riders who've received that is a who's who of riding.
Yes.
Riding royalty, and you're right in there with it. So congratulations, and more than that, it's, as I said, being awarded by your peers is the highest honor you can get, and for your professional conduct on and off races, you know, congratulations from all of us here.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you.
I'll let you go. Stuart Elliott, everyone, thanks again so much, Stuart. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thanks.
Okay, folks, that was wonderful. Stuart Elliott reliving a little bit the fun of 2004 with Smarty Jones. So just to thank him for his time, and he indicated that he might like a horse a little bit that he's riding on Saturday, a horse called You're Late out at Santa Anita. A horse could probably run well in his return. So thank you so much to Stuart Elliott. For joining us. We'll conclude two things here. As I said, I have some travel schedules, so we'll conclude with talking a little bit about the big cap, which we were talking about before. It's $750,000, a mile and a quarter. As we said, a lot of horses have disappeared to go to Dubai to run in the big race there, and it looks like it's Midnight Storm, who will be alone on the lead for Phil D'Amato. He's the only speed in the race Whether he gets a mile and a quarter is a bit of a question. He's not particularly bred for it. But he will be loose on the lead, and he'll probably be chased by Shaman Ghost, Javier Castellano, going out there for our friends Jimmy Jerkins, coming off a second-place finish to Arrogant, and probably a horse who has won at the distance, even though he's not particularly bred for either. One interesting horse in there is Isotherm, who's trying to try moving from the grass to the dirt to go after the big pot, and he's always a horse who's had a lot of talent. So with that, I want to thank everyone for joining us on this. If you're listening tonight, you know, please pass on the information that we have here. Please have a listening to things. I want to thank Stuart Elliott for joining us. Wonderful time for us to join us today. I thank him for his time. And I'm going to play, for anyone who missed it, I'm going to play our Steve Cawthon interview just to fill out the last half hour while I prepare to go catch my airplane. Thanks, everyone. Speak to you next week.
Good evening. Welcome to Racetrackers. I'm delighted to announce we have Steve Cawthon as our guest tonight. Good evening, Steve.
Hey, Bill. How you doing?
Fine, thanks. Steve, we're so happy to have you on the show tonight. It seems like only yesterday to a lot of us, but it was 40 years ago.
Yeah, right.
It was 40 years ago in 1977 for some of our listeners who are younger. When you set the world on fire in New York this month with an astounding, I believe it was 77 wins in the month of February. Is that correct?
You know, I don't even know, but I do remember I had 23 in 1 week or something, but I can't remember about. I didn't know about the month.
I mean, it was quite a time. You know, now in New York, I don't even know if we run 77 races in the month of February. But
<Yeah. laughs>
you know, but back then. We're so happy to have you on, and you know, obviously your accolades are so many. It's hard to go through, and I don't want to embarrass you, but for our listeners, you've won every possible award there could be as a jockey, and really had the distinction of being Sports Illustrated Sports Person of the Year, which is something an Associated Press Male Athlete of the Year and a Sporting News Athlete, Pro Athlete of the Year. It's the likes of notoriety that racing doesn't normally get in the wider range of things. So obviously, congratulations on that distinction.
Thank you. Yeah, it was an exciting time for sure.
I mean, when we speak about it, and again, so many of our listeners are younger, and you know, it was back in the day when we didn't have information that was so readily available. And if I remember correctly, when you were the leading apprentice in New York, and you know, in 1977, you would be listed. The entries didn't come out till the night before because the entries weren't taken very early, and there was no advanced daily racing form. But you would come out, and you would be listed on numerous horses at that time. Everybody wanted you to ride their horse. Do I recall that correctly, that you'd be listed on three or four horses?
Yeah.
When
I And I mean, that was, as you say, I think, you know, a lot of guys were trying to get me on their horse. And as you say, there was quite a few jockeys there, but, you know, they allowed my agent to do that. And then, you know, I think there was a certain time where they had to, you know, secure, you know, an exact jockey. Once, you know, we figured out what we were going to do, and then, you know, they had to, you know, everybody else had to get, you know, somebody else.
To scramble for all the other rides.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just a tremendous run, and I remember, I don't know whether you recall this, but at least in racing circles, you know, the Eagles had a big song, said, you know, there's a new kid in town, and you were it. You know, when you came to New York, you kind of took it by storm. There was no question about it. And again,
it was crazy. I remember when I had to run, they made me go get my working papers. That was like a big deal, whether I was going to be able to get my working papers and
Because you were too young to ride in New York, or you had to have working papers to ride in New York.
I guess so. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I was just it was just something that all of a sudden they said you have to do this or else you can't ride, and it was a big panic. And there was in the paper, there was a big caricature of it the next day. Coffin gets his racing paper, his working papers.
That's great. Well, you know, there were, again, for our listeners who weren't around, it was so unbelievable because the numbers are different. But you earned $6 million in 1977. Your horses earned $6 million in purses.
Mm-hmm.
And that was considered unthinkable. I mean, you won like over 400 races, almost 500 races. But the $6 million number, and it coincided with a popular television show called The $6 Million Man, which was Lee
mm-hmm.
Majors and, I guess, Farrah Fawcett. And I remember them.
Right.
Sports Illustrated saying, right, you were the new $6 million man.
Yep, yep. That was, like you said, I think the Angel Cordero had the previous record, which was like $4 million something. So, yeah, it was at that time quite a step up. But like you said, nowadays it's like nothing. But it was, you know, like 487 races, I think it was. So
okay.
It was, I was working hard that year.
Yeah,
but,
no kidding.
But it was, like you said, it was, I think I won six races three times that year, maybe at Aqueduct.
Amazing. Back when the stands were full most days too.
Yeah, right. Well, I was talking to somebody the other day, you know, and even in the winter, you know, back in 77, 76, 77, that winter, you know, it wasn't unusual just on a regular weekday to have 10,000 people, you know, or 10 or 12,000 people, and on the weekends, you know, sometimes more. Of course, obviously the Wood, I think the Wood, you know, was more like 45 or 50,000 back then, you know.
Right.
And, I mean, you don't get that on the Breeders' Cup there, you know, not much more. So.
Right. It's all moved to television and on a computer.
Yeah.
I'm not so sure there's fewer people watching, but there's certainly fewer
people
watching.
No, right,
watching,
yeah, right, exactly. I'm just saying, yeah, that actually shows up at the racetrack, yeah.
Right. Well, if 1977 wasn't exciting enough for you, 1978 came along, and actually, late in 1977, you started riding Affirmed, and you started those battles
right.
with Affirmed and Allie Darren. And I think I saw all the New York ones as a kid, and I guess I kind of always thought that the only time Allie Darren seemed to beat Affirmed was an Affirmed didn't see him, and I think that happened once in his 2-year-old career. I don't remember exactly
yep.
what race it was, but he seemed like he passed
Champagne,
you far
yeah.
on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, in the Champagne,
yep.
he passed you far on the outside.
And it was a muddy track too, which was another thing that wasn't Affirmed's favorite thing.
Okay.
You know, he ran on it, but he, you know, he wasn't, you know, quite as confident and as you know, I just think he was, you know, better on a normal, you know, fast track. So, you know, there was kind of two things that day. But, yeah, you're right. Aladar, you know, came wide and on the outside. He got by me, and I didn't have time to, you know, to reengage. Just sort of he made such a, you know, accelerated so well on that track that, you know, I just didn't have time to get back at him.
Right. And that set up kind of the rivalry. And when you moved into 1978, you know, again, for our listeners, you know all this, of course, but just for our listeners who may have been younger and have heard about it but not been around, you know, you were with Affirmed was owned by Harborview Farm, who was Lou Wilson and trained by Laz Barrera, and you were up against the old guard in Calumet Farm. Allie Dar was owned by Calumet Farm and John Veach, and there was probably, I think in the racing commentators, and there were only few of them back then, there was probably a feeling that Allie Dar would get the better of Affirmed at some point due to his breeding and kind of a nostalgia back to Calumet being the
yeah.
You know, I don't think it was mean-spirited, but it seemed like it was always, no matter how many times Affirmed won, there were people saying, well, Allie Dar almost got there or was going to get there. And throughout all that, you know, I guess no one told you and no one told Affirmed, right, that he was supposed
right.
to get passed by.
Thank God. Thank God.
You know,
yeah,
I mean,
you know, it was a unique build up, and like you said, it started as 2-year-olds. The first time I rode Affirmed against Aladar was in the Hopewell, and that's the day that I really realized what a special horse he was, and that Aladar was also. You know, because we just, you know, I mean, I'd never at that point in my career accelerated down the stretch, you know, the stretch like I'd, you know, did in that race. And, you know, they went well clear of the rest of the field. And he held, Affirmed beat Aladar by, you know, half a length or whatever it was. And then we came back to the New York to Belmont for the futurity, and I beat him in those. And then, you know, a few weeks later, Aladar beat me in the Champagne. So luckily for us, you know, neither we or them were afraid of each other. You know, we both, you know, were very confident in our horses. And Laz kind of talked, you know, kind of challenged them to take us on in the Laurel. We were going to go to Laurel, you know. He said, if Aladar can come, if he thinks he's good enough, type of thing.
Right.
And luckily they did. And then, you know, so we beat them in the Laurel Futurity and, you know, ended up getting the two-year-old champion, you know, that year in the Eclipse Awards. And then, like you said, you know, we went to the West Coast and they went to the East Coast for the winter. And, you know, that was the exciting, you know, build up to the 1978 Derby.
Right. And I mean, you moved to the Derby and you moved to the Preakness, and now you're on to the Belmont. And, you know, I guess Seattle Slough had just won a Triple Crown the year earlier, and Secretariat had won it a few years before that in 1973. But there was still excitement with the Triple Crown, and there was still kind of a belief that Aladar would get a measure of revenge in the longer distance. And with that, he decided to kind of engage you earlier. And there's a famous race call, and I've always disputed this, and I want to get your opinion on this. And not to criticize, I believe it was Chick Anderson, the race caller, but he said Aladar puts a head in front. And I've never really seen that in the stretch in the Belmont. Did he ever actually get ahead of you?
He certainly got even with me. Whether he got, you know, if he got ahead of me, it was a nostril, you know, or, you know, it wasn't very far. But, it was, you know, he certainly, you know, he was even with me at one point there. You know, I mean, I thought, you know, it was a hell of a call. I mean, I remember, you know, I think Chick Anderson was one of the best of all time. And, you know, not only, you know, his call with Secretariat, but also that one, you know, it was a heck of a call. And, you know, it just, you know, showed, you know, like two champions. It was almost like a boxing call, you know.
Right.
You know, like they, you know, like it was with those two. You know, it was almost an alley Frazier kind of, you know, back and forth. You know, nobody knew what was going to happen till we got past the finish line.
Right.
I didn't know. You know, I mean, I knew at the head of the lane that my horse was, you know, he felt a little bit fatigued under me. Aladar was right there fighting, you know, and that's the first time I ever hit him left-handed. But, you know, and being the gutsy horse he was, he just dug in deep and, you know, got his head back in front. And once he did, you know, I just felt like, you know, we were going to hang in there, but which we did. But I think it was Bill Knack that, you know, he said it was like Moby Dick or looking back at Ahab. You know, it was one of those, just a real dogfight, you know. And, you know, the amazing thing was Aladar kept coming back after, you know, all those tight defeats, you know. So, yeah, I don't even think he probably ever knew he was losing, you know. He probably thought he won.
Well, there is a certain solace in that for horses' connections, right, that they know they lost, but sometimes the horses don't when it's that tight. I guess Mike Smith said that about Songbird this year when he lost to Holden, that she's unaware of the fact that, you know, the wire came up at the wrong time. Well, through the whole thing, it was so exciting, and I'll tell you an aside, on my aside, I was selling mutual tickets at Belmont that day.
And, oh, really?
Yeah, and they had at that time, they thought it was a good idea not to have television in the bays, so you couldn't watch the races live where you were working, watch them on television where you're working, but you could bring, you had to bring your money to the money room after each race. So I remember scrambling up with my money to get to the money room and finding a spot, a perch to watch it on one of the catwalks on the TV.
Right.
And I was younger and probably more interested in it than everybody. And I got a front row seat and I can see it. And people were asking me what I saw because they couldn't see it. So I delivered kind of a word by word description to the people who couldn't see it. And I had no doubt you had won the photo. It was just tremendously, tremendously exciting. And at such a young age, it just must have been a tremendous amount of pressure, but you handled it with such aplomb, it seemed. And as did the connections of Alidar. It was just something the whole racing world should have been proud of, you know.
I think they should too. I think, as you say, I think they were very good, you know. John Veitch was, you know, I know it killed him, but
right.
He was, you know, like you said, just like it would have killed us if we'd have gotten beaten the Belmont, you know, because it would have, you know, we wouldn't have been able to fulfill the dream of trying to win the Triple Crown. But, you know, that's what it's all about. That's what sports is about. And, kind of, you know, the same, you know, like winning or losing the Super Bowl, you know, it's just the biggest day in racing. And, you know, I thought they did handle it, you know, fantastically well. It was a truly classic fight all the way through.
Right, just so exciting. And then, you know, we won't go on with it. As it turned out, you weren't riding him when he was disqualified in the Travers. And we've discussed this on the show before. Mm-hmm. What a shame that was. That was a another matchup that never really came to pass because of some you know unfortunate luck on the racetrack.
Yeah.
But you decided to leave New York. You moved to California for a little while.
I followed a firm to California, you know. He went back out there for the next firm, you know. So the only reason that I was, you know, going to California was really to go with a firm. Yeah,
right.
And Laz, you know. So
and his four-year-old.
Yeah,
right.
And I had done that the winter before, you know, so there wasn't any, you know, it wasn't any big deal. The real thing was is I had a fall up at Saratoga that summer and fractured my knee, and I was out for about 2 months or a month and a half, you know. Almost, you know, 6 or 8, 7 weeks, I can't remember. When I came back, you know, it was just, I had a hard time getting things back, you know, back going again. You know,
okay.
It was slow to get started. And then soon after that, we went out to California, which obviously wasn't my backyard. My agent, Lenny Goodman, had a heart attack, and he was recovering from that. And so eventually we got out there, but, you know, Laz's horses, you know, we'd had a long, hard year, and, you know, they just, right at the beginning of the year, you know, they weren't really, we didn't get off to, any kind of a start at all, just kind of, horses were getting beat, you know, that were favorites, and, you know, it's one of those things, you know, it doesn't matter how, you know, much success you've had, you know, you're only as good as your last, you know, win, really, in reality, in anything, you know,
right.
Doesn't matter. You know, let Tom Brady, you know, lose for a while, and, you know, everybody will just say he's washed up.
so that's
what they were saying about me, you know. And, you know, they were pretty hard on me pretty quick. And it just kind of, you know, I, without a doubt, you know, I lost some confidence. And, you know, just kind of one thing led into another, and I went through a, you know, pretty long losing streak, which, you know, it sounds, you know, it all happened probably in about 3.5 weeks, you know.
Right.
But, you know, I never gave up. I mean, I kept fighting and kept trying. And eventually, although I lost the mount on affirmed, you know, I ended up, you know, finally winning the race for Laz, you know.
Okay.
He gave me a mount on a horse called Father Duffy, and, you know, we had won. And I won a few other races, you know, but it just, you know, it was a struggle because, you know, all the other California trainers weren't offering me, you know, mounts, or if they were, they weren't offering me good ones, you know. I was just getting scrubs, you know, whatever was left over. And, you know, out of the blue, I got an offer to go to Europe. So from, you know, an owner who I'd ridden some for out in California, he had, you know, sent a few horses out there for the winter, and Robert Sangster. And, you know, he had a huge stable over in Europe. Most of his best horses were with Vincent O'Brien, but he also had a pretty good sized stable in England with a trainer called Barry Hills, and so he came and offered me the job to go over to England and ride for Barry Hills. And they had a pretty good they'd had a horse called Hawaiian Sound who had just finished second, you know, the year before in the Epsom Derby, and so, you know, he was obviously going to be one of my mounts. And I just decided it was a good time to, you know, try a new challenge and try something different, you know, things that kind of gone the wrong way for me at that point, and I didn't see any reason not to give it a chance and the other thing that Mr. Sangster mentioned to me, he says, long term, you're going to end up in Europe anyway because of your weight. And,
right.
You know, as it turned out, you know, that was very true. And after thinking about it, I said, I want to give it a shot. And so I did.
Well, you're being too modest because Robert Sangster and Vincent O'Brien, for our listeners, were really European racing royalty at the time. As you said, they were a huge, powerful stable. And
right.
and for them to reach out to you was a tremendous pride.
Yeah, I was honored. You know, like you said, I felt like, you know, it was a shot in my arm, especially at that time. And, you know, went like anything, you know. Kind of like Nick Cannon, you know. you want to work for people that want you, you know. So
right.
I decided that it was a good time to give it a try.
And that was uncommon at the time. There weren't many riders who went to Europe to ride.
No, I was the first in a long time. I mean, you know, through history there had been a few, you know, Todd Sloan, you know, and a few others that had gone over and had some, you know, quite a bit of success, but it hadn't happened for quite a while. Mainly too because you know, American racing had been doing so well, you know, so guys wasn't like you know, the purse structures in England are, you know, on the day-to-day basis are a little less. You know, the big races are pretty good, but you know, day-to-day, I mean, you know, some of the races are, you know, pretty low, you know, even at what, you know, they consider decent meets.
Right.
So, yeah, it wasn't like, you know, I mean, the one thing is, you know, you get a job and you get a retainer, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't something that a lot of people were dying to rush across there to do. But, you know, my situation, you know, I got a good offer and I thought it was worth, you know, trying.
Well, it was a world of experience for you. I mean, you got to ride and win big races in Great Britain, France, Germany, Ireland, Italy. I was lucky enough to see your victory in the Irish Derby in when you rode Old Vic in 1989.
Right.
I was
mm-hmm.
at the Curragh with my wife and sisters. That was back when I had money and energy and I was working for Pan Am, so we had free flights, so we went to races all over the world, you know. So
cool.
I cashed a bet on you. It was a decent-sized price with Old Vic, and
yeah.
it was just tremendous amount of excitement. Now, on a personal note, if I remember correctly, you spent enough time in England that you developed an English accent for a little while. Am I right about that? I definitely did,
yeah. I mean, I think it's, you know, the thing was that I was really – I hadn't even turned 19 by the time I went over to England. I was – you know, like about 2 months shy of my 19th birthday. So, you know, I was still young and, you know, it wasn't like I tried to pick up an English accent, but it just kind of like, you know, it just happens. You know, you're around it and, you know, you find out what, you know, just you hear other people talk and, you know what they say to get what they want. So, you know, it's easier to do it, you know, if you explain it the way they do, and it just kind of happened. So
right.
I did have a you know, pretty strong accent, but by the time when I got home, within a year, it just basically disappeared.
That's funny.
Just from being back home.
I remember, and I don't remember exactly what race it was. I guess it was the English Derby, but I guess a couple of times you've met the Queen at the races, right? When she gives out the trophy, and that's
right.
Got to be
the Queen and the Queen Mother. Were the main two who gave the trophies out at Ascot. And so, yeah, I actually got to know the Queen Mother quite well. And
really?
Obviously met the Queen quite a few times, and, you know, she gave me quite a few trophies through the years. And Princess Anne, got to know her quite well. I met Princess Diana. She was after I won my first Derby on slip anchor. Because she had gone to the races that day, and you go up to the Royal Box after winning the Derby.
Right.
So that was cool. Yeah, I mean, you know, the fact that royalty's so involved in racing is, you know, a really cool thing in, you know, English racing.
Well, it's hard to imagine people like us working with royalty and being the Queen other than in a racing world. I mean, it's one of the wonderful things about the racing world, right? You get to go everywhere and see everyone.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, Yeah, I mean, I met Eric Clapton and Elton John and Roger Waters and all that through racing, you know, because they had some connection one way or the other, and it was pretty cool.
Now, I've told this story on the air before, but I forget which Derby it was. It was the Epsom Derby, and I'm trying to think who won it. But I was there, and Princess Di and Sarah Ferguson were in the royal box, and someone streaked down the center of the course. That was all
right.
The rage then, people streaking.
Right,
And the Queen stood up and turned her back, and Princess Di stood up and turned her back, but I think Sarah Ferguson was in hot water because being the American she was. Yeah, she leaned out of the box and raised the glass and had a few laughs with people as they caught it on the course.
Yeah. Now they always gave her a hard time. They gave Princess Di, the royal family seemed to give Princess Di a hard time, but they definitely gave Fergie a tough time all the way through. But I got to meet her, a few times, and she seemed like a really nice gal, and she seems like she's tried hard to get everything back on track for herself and her kids. So,
right,
you know, I got nothing but good things to say about her.
Well,
that definitely happened in the press over there a lot. They picked and chose who they were fans of and who not.
it shows you
Definitely
how fast.
Overall, they were pretty good to me.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, it's just a tremendous world of experience. It's amazing how fame is fleeting. I mean, I don't have to tell you. You were famous. I never was. But when I mentioned to my kids, Fergie, they're talking about the singer for the Black Eyed Peas. They don't even realize
right.
It was what somebody was.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right.
Royalty. But well, Steve, you came back and you're back in Kentucky. And
I am.
You're still an ambassador to the game, and I know you make various appearances. What do you think of the state of the game today? I'm sure you're pleased with how it's going, but do you have any particular thoughts about things in the future?
You know, I think there's, certainly good things, and things that are tough. Technology's been good in a lot of ways, as you say. I mean, people can be involved with racing and not actually be there, but of course that makes it tough for racetracks and stuff. When people don't actually show up at the venue. I just think racing's kind of. I think at one point there was just too many horses and too many races. I remember before I really started, I guess they said back in the day, there wasn't really racing in the winter in New York or up that in the East.
Right.
And that, the break, whether it was whatever it was, 2 months or 3 months, whatever it was something that was good in the end because when racing came back, everybody couldn't wait. It's kind of like baseball. I mean, can you imagine playing baseball 365 days a year?
Right.
I mean, the same sort of thing. It's like some too much of anything, even a good thing, cannot be the best for the sport. So, I think that obviously, keeping the quality up and having maybe slightly less, racing overall is probably something that, is just going to happen naturally. Just, I think that's the way it's going to be, like as you said, back in the day, we were racing 6 days a week, year round up in New York, it was just the way it was. And now it's
right.
Down to, 4 or 5 days a week up there. And, some places like here at Turfway in Kentucky, it's, in the winter they race about 4 days a week. But the big thing is, you have to keep the, keep the fans. You have to keep generating and creating new fans, And as you say, there's a lot of young people that, there's just so many other options. Back in 1977, 78, there wasn't all the other, I think maybe the lottery was about to come in.
Right.
Or came in soon after that, around that time. But there wasn't legal gambling on all these other things. So, racing's just got a ton more competition, And I just think, I mean, I don't claim to know, you know, the answer, you know, so to speak, but I think, you know, obviously somehow we have to attract newer, younger fans and people that, you know, one, it's kind of like one of the things, you know, you, once you're around it, you know, it grabs you, you know, but you
right.
have to get people actually to the facility, to the track, and seeing the beauty of horses and, you know, the competition, you know, how great, exciting it is to have a, you know, a race like the Aleph Dar Affirmed, you know, Belmont, or Sunday Silence and Easy Goer, you know, those kind of things are great fillies, you know, like Ruffian, you know,
right.
just or spectacular performances, and then of course competition, and yeah, so you know, I like I said, it's hard to say what it, there's not exactly one thing. You know, I also kind of tend to think that basically people are right. You know, I mean, we have to have some sort of, you know, unified drug rules, like, you know, and obviously less or, you know, next to none is probably the best, you know. But it has to be universal. You know, you can't have it one way here and one way, it's a different way someplace else. You know, I think it should, you know, be like a universal situation for everybody all around
right.
the country.
Well, it just adds another level of complexity for
right.
gamblers, trainers, owners, everyone involved. I mean, you have
yeah.
you wind up having people have many drug positives and go unscathed, and other people have minute drug positives and have their reputations tarnished, and it
right.
doesn't seem to everybody
seem to be, yeah it doesn't seem like everybody's getting treated equally. You're right.
Right, the people outside the game don't know what to think. The people inside the game just roll their eyes because they
lucky ones to get away with it. Yeah, they're happy. they're not.
Right.
They're basically out of a job. So,
right,
it's pretty tough.
Well, I take some solace in the fact that I think television exposure, and I've written a little article on this, but I think television exposure is really what made other sports gallop ahead of, no pun intended,
I agree. Yeah.
Horse racing, and now I am heartened when I hear young people talk about the vagaries of different tracks, the way people used to talk about different ballparks. You know, the idea
right.
that somebody who's 18 years old in New York knows that Hawthorne Racetrack, you know, has tight turns, is something that never could have happened 30 or 40 years ago. You didn't.
Yeah.
You were lucky if anybody knew that it existed. You know, I think the television exposure will help, and I think. You know, I think the game is kind of settling in to a point where, you know, there are big days. I do think that from a gambling standpoint, when we do this show, it seems like every racetrack gives their best races on Saturday, which is a natural. But the Sunday cards are turning out to be weak. So I think some racetracks
right.
should pick up
the... Yeah, balance it out. Yeah, you're right. Try to, you know, like you said, especially if you're going up against, you know, New York, you know, on Saturday, who's got a huge card, you know, if you're New Jersey or, you know, Monmouth or somewhere else, you know, you should move your big races to Sunday. Yeah, I agree.
Right. Yeah, somewhere along the line.
Try to balance it out.
Yeah, somewhere along the line they thought that the quality on Sunday doesn't matter. And I guess if the quality doesn't matter, why do it on Sunday? You know, but I guess
right.
that would be the one change I would make. And I certainly hope New York gets its act together because they have big old aging facilities, and I don't know how long they're going to be able to keep the facilities that are largely unused, you know, most of the time. So somewhere along the
right.
line, that's got to be modernized. And I hope they bring the Breeders' Cup back to New York. But largely, I'm happy with how the game is shaking out these days, and it's still as exciting as ever. No question about that, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you watch Beholder and Mike's filly, the Songbird, you
right.
know, fight it out. You know, that was an amazing race. And of course, you know, Arrogate, you know, coming around and doing what he's done, you know, obviously California Chrome, you know, as you say, there's no end of exciting horses. It's an exciting year every year leading up to the Derby and the Triple Crown races, because you don't know what's going to happen. You know, all of a sudden, you know, a horse can just, you know, come on,
right.
you know, and just really develop, you know, right at the right time. You know, they may not make the Triple Crown, but, you know, they come good at, you know, the Preakness, and then, you know, finish the rest of the year and turn into, you know, a really superstar. And, you know, it's just it's a great game. And as you say, it's just a question of, you know, I think I agree with you. I think, people were, were afraid, the racing people were afraid of television, thinking that, it wouldn't, would keep people away from the track. And to some degree, I guess that's true. But, like you said, nowadays they can be involved, wherever they're at, even
right.
if they're not at the track. So, as you say, there's a lot of good things. And the big thing is, hopefully, like you said, more and more young people are starting to understand, more about the game, and it's probably easier in some ways because of the technology to learn, a lot about racing, without actually having to be at the track all the time.
Right. I mean, we have people who call up and tell me about handicapping methods where they watch replays of the races simultaneously from the head on and the pan shot. That's something that,
right.
we couldn't have done.
Never
and
used
it's
to.
A,
no.
Right. Just unbelievable.
No, I mean, like you said, it's great because, you can watch a race anywhere around the country, pretty much any time of the day or night. In the middle of the night, you can watch races in Australia if you want to, in the middle if you want to stay up and watch it two in the morning,
Steve, you and I are the same age, and so, sleeping gets more difficult as you get older, but I get up in the middle of the night anyway, but I set my alarm for 1:25 in the morning the other day and watched Winx win her 14th straight race in Australia, My wife just kind of shook her head, and said, "Well, I should be used to this by now,
People that aren't as entwined to it as we are don't really understand. But I guess it's the same with a lot of things. I don't understand why why people want to stay up all night and watch Dancing with the Stars or something.
Well, to see Victor Espinosa, I guess.
I guess that I would stay up for.
Well, Steve, I'm so proud to have you on. I can't thank you enough, and I know you have things to do tonight. I can't thank you enough for being on here. We're a small show, but we put out a quality product, and we have loyal listeners, and we just each week we try to speak with racing personalities, and I really didn't want the 40-year anniversary of you setting New York on fire in February to go unnoticed. I can't tell you how thankful we are for being on, and what a great response we've gotten from people who are excited to hear this interview. So I can't thank you enough. Please, I certainly hope you won't be a stranger.
Keep watching the races and going to the track and enjoying, the greatest sport on earth.
Great. Thank you so much. Steve Cawthon, everyone. Thanks again, Steve.
Okay, buddy. All the best.
Okay, everyone. With that, we'll be signing off tonight. Hope all is well. Good luck. May all your horses break alertly.